You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We're going to be talking today to Elizabeth Kohlberg. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's the author of several books, including The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize. She will be in Santa Fe speaking at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts on Friday, the 1st of June, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research and co-sponsored by the Nature Conservancy. The Sixth Extinction was published a few years ago, but I just read it now for the first time, and I have to say, this is one of those books you should put on your must-read list, not only because it's on absolutely the most important issue of our time, namely how human beings are making an impact on the natural world, but also because it's just so well written and so accessible to ordinary people. Like, it uses familiar images to help you understand unfamiliar things, and you go all over the world, you get your heart broken, and you get kind of a reality check on where we are right now in history, both human history and geological history. And the book, of course, leaves you with the most important question of all, what are we going to do? Which I hope we'll talk about a little bit in this hour. Let's go now to Elizabeth Kohlberg. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you write about both extinction, which is a normal part of life and evolution, and mass extinction, which is fairly rare. It's happened only 5 times so far in the history of the Earth, and the last one was like 65 million years ago. When we look at the current mass extinction that's going on now, we talk about human-generated phenomena like climate change, habitat destruction, pollution, population growth. But the roots of human-caused extinction, which you write about in your book, which is so interesting to me, that go a lot further back than the Industrial Revolution. Talk about some of the past human-caused extinctions. For example, the disappearance of some very large mammals that happened before we even started burning fossil fuels.
Yeah, so that's what's referred to as the megafauna extinction. And if you go around the world, you see that there used to be, in the geologically and evolutionarily speaking, not very distant past, very large animals in North America, South America, Australia, and now they're pretty much all gone. Mammoths, mastodons, there's a whole menagerie of very large animals. In Australia, they were marsupials, these huge marsupials, including something that was like a marsupial lion almost. And people have realized this for quite a long time because some of the first, in fact, what even led to the people understanding that extinction had taken place was some of these enormous remains that they found of mammoths, of mastodons. So people have realized for a long time that these animals are missing. And there's been a long, long standing debate about why, but I think very much in recent years, I think most scientists would say, well, it's pretty clear that human hunting pressure was a major cause, because if you look at the timing on these extinctions, they always occur after humans arrived in a new place. So humans have been in Australia actually for a very long time, 50, 60,000 years even. And that megafauna, those large animals, went extinct, you know, 30, 40,000 years ago. And then we come to the Americas and we had mastodons here. We had mammoths. We had giant beavers. We had saber-toothed tigers, all these things we find in the fossil record or the not quite fossil record. And they're all gone now. And that also coincides with when people arrived in the New World. There was just recently a paper, in fact, that suggests that actually, if you look further back in the record, it's possible that even our ancestors, so not even what we would consider modern humans, already began this process in Europe and Africa before modern humans even evolved.
And they weren't taking out a lot of animals, and they were completely unaware that they might have even been causing extinctions. Which is so interesting, because now looking back, we have the scientific method to understand those things. But what were the long-term effects of losing those large animals? Is there a continuity between that set of extinctions and the ones we're living through now?
Well, I think that, you know, one point to make is that we're probably even still disproportionately losing large animals. I mean, there's a huge spasm of extinction going on right now that's affecting relatively large mammals. If you think of elephants are endangered, rhinos are endangered, apes are endangered, giraffes are now considered endangered or on the cusp of being endangered. So large animals that are slow to reproduce, if you depress their birth rate in any way, either by, you know, killing them or just cutting into the survival rate of young, you're going to be pushing down that population, and eventually they're going to be headed towards extinction. So that is a sad continuity. Now, we've also introduced lots and lots of other ways to drive animals toward extinction. So there's continuities, and then there are some things that are very, very new in what we're doing.
When we look at the data that describes our current self-created climate change, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the melting of glaciers, global temperature, these things are not new in the history of the Earth, but they haven't happened in a really, really long time. When in the Earth's history have we last seen a comparable situation, and what kind of life forms were on Earth at that time?
Well, people have tried to look back at the climate in very great detail to try to answer that question. And the best records that we have of climate come from ice cores, but they run out about 800,000 years ago. So we're probably right now getting pretty close to the warmest that we've been in 800,000 years. And then we are going to, unless we do something very, very dramatic, we're going to push past that. And what we're going to push past that to is possibly a period called the mid-Pliocene warm period, which was about 3.5 million years ago, when sea levels were a lot higher than they are today because there was a lot less ice on the planet. But we could also be talking about pushing back to temperatures that haven't been seen on Earth for 40 or 50 million years in what's known as the Eocene. Now, if you go look at the Eocene record, there were, you know, alligators in Britain and palm trees growing up near the Arctic. So the world was much, much warmer. It was a very different place. And humans certainly didn't exist. Primates, you know, really barely existed 50 million years ago. So we're potentially pushing back into a regime that has not been seen on planet Earth for a very, very long time.
And for all the resilience and adaptability of species that spent a long time evolving, we're also faced with this reality that we don't know how either we or any of the other millions of species on Earth are equipped to adapt to conditions that they haven't seen for tens of millions of years.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big question marks, obviously, is there are evolutionary, you know, there are adaptations for dealing with heat, and everything that is around today has ancestors that were around 50 million years ago, because, you know, that's just the laws of evolution. But if those evolutionary adaptations to a warmer climate, we've actually been for the last few million years, we've been in a regime that's actually on the cold side of things, right? So we had ice ages, recurring ice ages. So there was a premium on actually being cold adapted. And so it's quite possible that, you know, a lot of groups of organisms have lost their ability to be warm adapted because they haven't had to use it in such a long time. And so, but to find out which those are and how things are going to adapt, unfortunately, you know, as many people have pointed out, we are running this global experiment without a control on it, and we just don't know the answer. Unfortunately, we're going to find out, and I think, unfortunately, the odds are that we're not going to like the results, but we've already set it in motion.
Let's talk for a moment about biodiversity, which is incredibly important. First of all, why is biodiversity so important? We talk about it all the time. We also talk about diversity within human societies. What is so important about it?
Well, I think there's a lot of ways to answer that. I mean, there's a practical way to answer that, which is just that there's a lot of work being done trying to look at what exactly is the functional utility of diversity, which, you know, arose for no particularly good reason. It arose because it arose, you know, because evolution has tended in that direction. But it seems like if you look at diverse ecosystems, they are just genuinely more productive. So that's sort of a practical functionality. Now, ecosystems are, you know, we see ourselves as very divorced from ecosystem functioning because we live in houses and we turn on the lights and we get our water out of a tank and all the appurtenances of modern life. But really, we're all still very, very attached to the biosphere. We eat food that is all grown or raised in some way connected to the natural world, and we breathe oxygen. So all of that, and we drink water that in many cases has been filtered through natural wetlands. And so we're all still very connected to this world, although the connections have been attenuated. So, you know, the question of what service biodiversity provides to us is very complicated, but it's doubtless true that we are dependent on many creatures, as I say, for things as basic as oxygen that we wouldn't want to lose. Now, then we get to another question, which is simply, we are not the only things on the planet. Biodiversity, by its very nature, tells us that we share this planet with millions of other species. We do not know how many. And as we kill them off, we may be harming ourselves. We are certainly harming them. And I think that that is a, you know, ethical question that we really ought to be paying a lot more attention to.
It's true. I sometimes think about people who claim that they're pro-life and wonder if they're pro-all life. I mean, this question of whether we have even the right to destroy so many species and whether we can survive that. I mean, that's the big question. I think when we built cities, we turned toward each other, toward human societies, instead of and sort of forgot about, to some extent, nature out there from which we came. And it's almost like, I feel like there's this idea that we can all sort of live on hydroponics, pretend the rest of the world doesn't matter. But to what extent is our own survival threatened? Do we even know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the question, unfortunately, of our time. And I think the honest answer would be, we don't know. People have used a lot of different metaphors. The Stanford biologist Paul Ehrlich uses the examples of rivets on a plane. You know, you have a lot of redundancy. You've built the plane so that it can lose one rivet, it can lose two rivets. But at a certain point, you pop a rivet and you find out, well, I really needed that one, and the plane crashes. And as I said, not to harp on this, but we are running an uncontrolled experiment. We're not doing this in a, oh, let's see which rivets we don't need. We're just willy-nilly doing things, and species are dropping out as a consequence. And I want to say whole ecosystems are dropping out. For example, coral reefs are in really big trouble owing to a combination of factors, but primarily right now rising ocean temperatures. And coral reefs are extremely important ecosystems. They're extremely important for marine life. Something like a quarter of all marine species spend at least part of their lives on a coral reef. Now, are they extremely important for people? They are extremely important for a lot of people. They're not extremely important probably directly for people sitting in the middle of the United States. But for coastal populations, for island populations around the world, the, you know, fish and the life and the protection that coral reefs provide is extremely important. So we're really testing already some of these boundaries that we're going to cross some of these boundaries in the next few decades even, and we're going to see the consequences. And I can't predict what they're going to be, but I think that if you devote not very much time to thinking about, okay, a world without coral reefs, you say, well, that's a much diminished world. Does it threaten human survival as a species? Perhaps not quite, but it threatens a lot of people.
About a decade ago, we interviewed Alan Weisman about his book, mm-hmm. The World Without Us. And I love that book. The premise of the book is, what would happen if human beings were to simply vanish tomorrow? Right. And that's a question that your work really brings up for me, namely, would the current mass extinction continue, or would nature's resilience kick in and heal and even start to reverse the damage that human beings have done? Do we know?
Well, I think if humans disappeared right now, a lot of pressures would start to ease. So one of the major things we've done is we've cut down a lot of forest and put in monoculture, right? You know, soy monoculture, wheat monoculture, rice monoculture. And if we just stop doing that, those areas, most of them, you know, some of them are probably permanently kind of degraded, but most of them would start reverting to forest, to sort of second growth forest. And so there'd just be a lot more habitat in the world. Now, one of the points that Alan Wiseman makes, as I remember in that first chapter, which is a very stunning chapter, is, you know, we've also done things like introduce cats everywhere. So the cats would multiply. Cats are a big problem for a lot of species. They eat a lot of birds. This is especially true in parts of the world where cats are not native. So they would reproduce like crazy, and they would still be causing a lot of damage. So, you know, the repercussions would not end with the end of us. You know, we've imported rats all around the world. The rats would thrive, even in our absence, probably. But a lot of pressures would ease up pretty soon after our disappearance. How's that?
Right, right. You have described and seen and witnessed a lot of things that most of us haven't. I mean, you've been in these bat caves where there are dead bats who have died of a certain kind of fungus, and you've seen areas that were once populated with huge numbers of frogs, and the frogs are all gone. And you write about events that happened before our lifetimes, like the killing of the great auks, these penguin-like birds. And I have to say, that story really got to me, not only because of the horrible killing of these creatures, but because, you know, it was British gentlemen collectors who wanted stuffed versions of them in their collections. And there are so many more stories. There are so many thousands of species disappearing every year. And I just wanted to ask you, like, to me, it's heartbreaking. How has this affected you and the many scientists that you've met through doing this work?
Well, I think it is heartbreaking. I think that is exactly the right word. And I've had this bizarrely mixed experience of having, as you said, some of these amazing experiences and of getting to amazing parts of the world, like the Amazon, like the Panamanian rainforest, like the Great Barrier Reef. And so that has been an incredible privilege and a joy, really. I mean, some of the most amazing experiences I've ever had, you know, in reporting this book on extinction. But to be aware of what's going on, as I certainly became through this book, and as many, many, many scientists out there live with this every day, and this is the focus of their work, it's very painful. As Aldo Leopold said quite a long time ago, I think he said, to have an ecological education is to live in a world of wounds. You see what's missing. I see my own. I live in the mountains, I guess we call them mountains, of Massachusetts. They're not really big mountains by Western standards. It's a part of the world that was very heavily farmed and deforested, and now actually is being reforested because the farming isn't really very good here. And it kind of looks, you know, it kind of looks even kind of wild, but I realize as a result of all this work that it really isn't. There's a huge number of species missing, and the forests are quite empty. So even places that look kind of wild these days are very, very, very different from what they were even just a couple hundred years ago before Europeans arrived here.
One of the things, going back to the question of biodiversity, that was interesting but sort of paradoxical for me, and maybe you could help us understand it, is biodiversity flourishes in areas that are geographically isolated, like islands, but not only islands, but places that are cut off, and that kind of allows for ecosystems that have a lot of different robust species. But then when those areas are connected by roads or by people flying in on airplanes or shipping tankers coming in with all kinds of creatures in their ships that disembark, and suddenly there's a lot of new species. Now suddenly in these formerly isolated places, there are more species from outside the bioregion, but ultimately biodiversity suffers. But then at the same time, you have sometimes these large ecosystems that are fragmented, again, by roads and cities and human activity, and they cause these artificial islands, but that also hurts biodiversity.
Right. Well, that does seem paradoxical. But first of all, isolation, the theory of evolution tells us that new species are created by being reproductively isolated. And one really good way to get reproductively isolated is to simply be isolated, right? So, you know, we see places like the Galapagos, like the Hawaiian Islands, have species that exist nowhere else on Earth. So a lot of what are called endemic species, because something arrives on the island, it's hard to get to the island, something gets there, we're not really sure how in a lot of cases, then it speciates and we get a lot of new species. So this, the Darwin's finches sort of story. Now, when you end that isolation, a lot of these creatures are naive. So, on islands, you tend to get, for example, a lot of birds that don't fly, flightless birds, for example, because they had no mammalian predators. They didn't need to fly. Flying was costly for whatever reason, and they evolve flightlessness. Then rats arrive, or foxes, or dogs, and those birds are in big, big trouble. So there's probably, I don't want to say literally a million examples, but hundreds of thousands of examples of this sort of thing. And so you get a lot of extinctions on islands that way. The populations just evolved in the absence of certain groups of organisms, then they arrive and they're simply killed off. Now, in terms of the way we're creating isolation, eventually, if you had an isolated spot, you know, in the Amazon or whatever, you know, eventually maybe you would get new species because they couldn't move. But in the meantime, in the short to medium time, in the human time scale that we're interested in, the effect of fragmentation is simply, you know, when you think about it, it makes sense. A big animal that needs a large territory to roam in, and he only has a tenth of the territory he used to have, is going to be in trouble. So we're disconnecting these places, and you get a lot of species dropping off because they just don't have the territory that they used to anymore. They have small, or they have very small populations on what's left of these fragments. They get inbred potentially, or there's simply some reproductive failure, and they just, so these populations just drop out. And people have studied this very, very carefully, and you can, you know, literally watch it happening. There's a very famous experiment that I went to visit in the Amazon where they kept certain forest fragments of different sizes and studied them as the Amazon sort of became deforested. And you could really watch in real time as different species dropped out of these fragments. And the smaller the fragment was, the faster the dropping out.
You describe in The Sixth Extinction a place called the Frozen Zoo, where specimens of animals are kept preserved in ice, some of these extinct species. What's the idea behind this? I mean, could they somehow be brought back to life and reintroduced into the wild if we ever got our act together?
Well, you know, the idea behind it is less sci-fi than that. The Frozen Zoo is in San Diego. It's connected to the San Diego Zoo. It is part of the San Diego Zoo. And the idea is to have a record, to have a repository of species genetic and certain amount of genetic diversity so that we will have that on liquid nitrogen. Now, already work is being done. For example, there are very highly endangered rhino populations whose DNA is in the Frozen Zoo, and people are trying to think, okay, is there a way that we could breed these rhinos? They would have to be carried, the young would have to be carried by a different species of rhino perhaps, or subspecies, but by having this DNA, then, you know, maybe we can assist in that effort as sort of more of a surrogate mother kind of effort rather than bringing species back to life effort. There are also questions, you know, a lot of species are in trouble because they have reached a genetic bottleneck. If you have some of the tissue preserved, you can look at, you know, where they've lost genetic diversity, and maybe that will help you at least diagnose some problems. It's not inconceivable, given where genetic engineering is going, that if you've lost some diversity, you could reintroduce that diversity. In fact, there are efforts to do that going on even as we speak, people looking at that sort of thing. And then the most out there is, you know, could you simply recreate these species by having their DNA on ice? And I think that the general thought is that's not impossible given the way genetics are going. But I think the other part of that, and it's a very serious problem, is animals are not just the sum of their DNA, as you can think of from yourself. They're the product of a lot of learning. They're the product of the microorganisms that live in their gut. There's all sorts of things that go into being an organism. And so even if you could faithfully recreate, let's say, you know, a mammoth, which would be very, very difficult with, you know, with current technology would be impossible, but might one day be possible. Would you really have a mammoth if you didn't have any mammoth parents teaching you how to be a mammoth?
Right. Very interesting. The political response to climate change and species extinction worldwide, and particularly in the United States, and especially under the current president, has been pretty pathetic and not up to the not up to the challenge of what is actually needed. What do you think it would take for a robust and effective change and set of new policies, new ways of working to happen that takes into account both our needs as a civilization and the rest of the world's creatures?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I mean, I've spent a long time thinking and writing about and talking to people who make this their life's work. And I don't think anyone has an answer. And if anyone does have an answer, I wish they'd get in touch with me. I think in the case of climate change, you don't even have to care about biodiversity. You should be extremely worried about climate change because it is going to have tremendous social ramifications. You know, even if it's not going to cause the end of humanity, it's going to be extremely disruptive. So disruptive in some parts of the world, potentially, that it will have really important and very serious geopolitical implications. So anyone who is not worried about climate change, anyone who is either under 30, let's say, or has kids who are under 30, should be extremely worried about climate change. You know, another thing that people really have to appreciate is that there's a time lag in climate change. So we haven't even experienced yet all the climate change that we have made inevitable. But moreover, we just keep adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere at a very, very rapid rate and making the problem worse and worse. So there's was just a piece the other day about a joint, I think it was British and American effort to go study a glacier called Thwaites Glacier on Antarctica because scientists are worried that we have already set the process into motion by which it will melt, which will mean a huge sea level rise of several feet. So we are talking major changes on the planet and whether societies as they are currently constructed can survive that kind of disruption is seriously an open question at this point. And I don't really understand anymore how everyone can be in such denial. The United States military, I should add, is not in denial, and they appreciate that this is a very, very serious geopolitical threat.
One of the things I was really intrigued by in your book, and that I've been thinking about myself for a long time, is this kind of great shift in thinking that was brought about by Charles Darwin in seeing human beings as a species that evolved just like every other species, that we didn't have any special status among the great diversity of animals and plants on Earth. And this was a departure from a more like theological view that we were specially created by God and stood apart from all the other creatures. But in a sense, we do kind of have a special status, for better or worse, because we have this hugely creative and also hugely destructive set of powers, like we build civilizations, we cause extinctions. And it seems like nobody wants to give up the fruits and comforts of civilization, even as we know the harm that we're doing by being ourselves. I feel like I struggle with this all the time. How do you understand it? I mean, is this a fundamentally human problem that we can we think ourselves out of it?
You know, you've asked the great question of our time. How's that? I don't have the answer to that. One school of thought, well, you know, we've always thought our way out of problems before. Humanity has faced a lot of crises. And there's another school of thought, which I think is more accurate, which is, well, we've never faced a problem like this. And I think the answer is it's a very open-ended question, and we just don't know the answer. We are plunging headlong, thoughtlessly. We are sleepwalking into, you know, scientists refer to this as a sort of no analog situation. There's just no analog in the entire history of life on this planet. And, you know, are we so smart that we're going to figure it out at the last possible minute, like in some Hollywood movie? You know, possibly. But I think the odds that that is, are going to happen smoothly and without, you know, disruption for many, many millions of people, including potentially those living, you know, right here in the US of A, grow smaller with each passing day. And the longer we pretend that these problems aren't coming at us, because they're not just coming at us, they have come at us. The likes of Harvey and Irma and all of the destruction we saw this past spring and many, many thousands of people displaced, that's just a preview of what's to come.
Do you feel like there are individual actions that you and I and our listeners can take that make a difference?
Well, I mean, the key, one of the key things to do right now, the most obvious and probably important thing to do right now is to really change our energy systems and to, you know, the key thing that Americans can do is get their heads out of the sand and vote for people who are going to put in place policies that are going to push our energy systems in the right direction. You know, right now we have a crew in power that is trying to protect coal. What could be crazier than that? At the moment that you realize there's almost nothing more destructive that you could be doing than burning coal, we are trying to revive the coal industry. I really think that if there are historians around a century from now, they will look at this moment, exactly 2018, as this moment of sheer madness. You know, the way that we look at like the lead up to World War II, for example, it will just look really like these people were insane.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Elizabeth Colbert is author of several books, including The Sixth Extinction. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And once again, Elizabeth Colbert will be in Santa Fe at the Lensic Performing Arts Center on Friday, the 1st of June, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. For more information, you can go to sarweb.org. And for tickets to the event, ticketssantafe.org. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.